Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the London School of Economics and on behalf of the Department of International Relations, I would like to welcome you all to this meeting this evening. I'm Professor Fred Halliday of the Department, a former convener, with no special competence in the field of China at all, and it's an enormous pleasure to welcome my colleague Dr. Christopher Hughes here, an enormous pleasure to be rising in this theatre and not to have to work or give a talk, but to be able to listen and inform myself on another matter. The school has, as the very name of this theatre indicates, a long-established connection with China and with the study of China. Dr. Hughes's predecessors included Dr. Michael Liefer, Dr. Michael Yehuda, and others. And we are aware in many of our departments, the Economics Department, the Center for Study of Global Governance, the Language Department, as well as the Department of International Relations, of the enormous changes which are taking place in a country that encapsulates a quarter of humanity. There are three particular aspects of Dr. Hughes's work that I think are relevant for all of us who study in international relations. The first is the study of nationalism, of which this school has a long and distinguished tradition. We recently lost a very close colleague of ours, Dr. Dominique Jacquin-Burdel, who was a specialist on nationalism in the Horn of Africa. But one of the strengths of the study of nationalism is that it's informed not just by social theory and by a knowledge of European history, but also by the different nationalisms of different parts of the world. I'm a specialist on the Middle East, and Dr. Jacquin and her colleagues on Africa. And Chris Hughes, who's already published a book on nationalism in the case of Taiwan, has made a very distinguished contribution to the study of nationalism in regard to China, a tradition which I trust the school will continue. Second is the vexed but inexorable question of the role of culture in international relations, a subject on which most authors in international relations have been thunderously silent these past 100 years. And yet anybody who's a student of empire or a student of globalization or a student of migration or a student of religion will be aware of the role of culture in international relations, including language, national susceptibilities, and the rest. Whether this necessarily includes religion is a matter of debate. I well recall a meeting in the school in 1985 with the French philosopher Régis Debray, speaking in French, who argued that all modern politics was an expression of religion. And Professor Eric Hobsbawm was sitting in the front row. He asked the most devastating question I've ever heard in an academic debate. He said, "Où est le Dieu caché dans l'Empire chinois?" Where is the hidden God in the Chinese Empire? But clearly, God or no God, religion or no God, culture is a very important factor. And I will never forget a meeting in the mid-90s in the school where our IR colleagues and theorists were getting very worked up about culture and incommensurable civilizations and clash of civilizations. And our young colleague Chris Hughes got up and he said, "What's all the fuss about?" He said, "You get down to it, you work, you learn the language, you live in the country, you study it, and then all this nonsense about clash of civilizations or incomprehensibility of civilizations disappears," he said, "but you've got to do the work and stop waffling on about incommensurability and clashes of this or that." And I'm very much of his opinion in this matter. Thirdly, Chris Hughes is a staunch representative of a tradition that is under threat in these parts and, more importantly, on the other side of the Atlantic, which is area studies, the belief that to understand the modern world, you have to know the history, you have to know the language, again, you have to do the work, you have to live in the country, and while not conceding to the idea that countries are unique or non-comparable, you have to know the background and the sensibilities of each country, and that richness is represented in his work. I do not claim any special knowledge of China, but I would insert two particular anecdotes which have come my way. Courtesy of colleagues in the University of Kent, I did teach for a while in the summer at the Beijing People's University, no longer called that, by the way, in 1995. It was July 1995, the 50th anniversary of the surrender of Japan. And my students were united in their belief that the issue of Japan and its so-called or apparent failure to apologize was the subject on which they were incensed. But representing LSE as I did in the nationalism debate, I gave my standard lecture on the theories of nationalism, the relationship between atavistic views of nationalism, atavism in the sense that nations had existed for many centuries, and the more modernist view that nations had come into existence in the last 200 years, a view which I hold and Dr. Jacques Berdel hold, and also held by Ernest Gellner. I'd given the same lecture in two other cities, in Tel Aviv and in Cairo. And in all three, Beijing and Tel Aviv and Cairo, I got exactly the same response. Very interesting lecture, Professor. And you Europeans obviously need all this modernist invention of nations and stuff. But we're an ancient nation and we've been here many thousands of years and we don't need your modernist theories. Thank you very much. It was an interesting comparison of the three cases. Of greater concern to anybody with a knowledge of modern history, with the awareness that the great wars of the 20th century did not begin in the Balkans, but began in 1894 between China and Japan, is the growing tension between China and Japan, something that I think all of us are aware of. I recently had dinner with a former student who's married to a prominent Japanese ambassador. At dinner, they were inveighing against China for blocking Japan entering the Security Council. Just as I was leaving, this ex-student was putting on my coat. She said, oh, by the way, Professor, what will you think when we get nuclear weapons? And that sent something of a chill down my back. I'd like to end with two questions or observations for Chris. I think one is, and this goes for all of us who study nationalism, how unique is it? How different is it? All nationalists think they're unique. But in many ways, it's modular. In many ways, it's the same. I remember after a seminar at the National University in Singapore asking colleagues what they were working on, and they said, we're working on a Confucian theory of international relations. And when I had dinner or lunch in Cairo, indeed, of duck's feet, which I shall never forget, with the colleagues from the People's University, I asked them what they were working on, and they said a Confucian theory of international relations. I strongly suspect the Confucian theory of international relations will defend sovereignty, against international criticism, will defend the right to economic development, and will conform to a modular universal program. There's one matter in which Chris's book has already been overtaken by events, which is this. It is not recent decisions of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, but of greater moment, recent decisions of the Promotions Committee of the London School of Economics. The book says that Chris is a senior lecturer. He has now been appointed a reader, on which I congratulate him, and we look forward to his talk very much.
Thank you very much, Fred. That's always a hard act to follow. Thank you all for turning out tonight in such large numbers. I expect the reason that many of you are interested in this topic is perhaps the spectacle of the anti-Japanese demonstrations, which actually became riots in China, especially in Shanghai, the most globalized of Chinese cities, last April. This, as shown on the cover, it's not very clear here, I'm afraid, encapsulates, I suppose, the paradox of a rising nationalism in China in the context of an increasingly globalized society. If you could see it a bit more clearly, this is an anti-Japanese demonstration taking place in the midst of a lot of signs in Shanghai advertising Samsung and 7-Up and 9-11. And no doubt many of the demonstrators are wearing probably Nike's manufactured in China. So that's the kind of paradox that we have to deal with, not just in China, but in many places in the world. But China seems to represent this in a fairly acute form because of the rather strong sense of nationalism that we are now witnessing. There has been a fair amount of, well, not a lot, actually, not enough, but there has been some literature on the subject of the rise of nationalism in the 1990s in China, when it really became more salient again. Most of that work is very useful and very good, but it's preliminary work, and of course it's mainly of the kind of survey type. You get a whole survey of different perspectives, points of view, schools of thought. Professor Yan Shui-tong says, let's attack Taiwan. Professor Fang Li-zhi says, we need more globalization in China. Mr. Wang Xiaodong says we need to strengthen China's internal solidarity in order to face up to the West, and so on and so on. What I've tried to do is something new with this kind of material. It's really three new things that I've tried to do. One is to treat nationalism and globalization as discursive concepts, and I'll say a bit more about what I mean by that in a minute. The second thing is to locate this discussion that's going on in China of nationalism and globalization within the period of reform and opening, which really began in the late 1970s with the return of Deng Xiaoping to power. Most of the recent works on the Chinese nationalist revival tend to start with 1989, the Tiananmen massacre and the end of the Cold War. I think we need to go back further and see it as really the ideological side of reform and opening. Thirdly, and I think this is probably the most important element of this work, I want to look at the linkages between ideology and policy making, because I don't think it's enough just to describe ideas and tell us what people are saying, but we need to ask ultimately what does that mean for policy making in some key areas. So what do I mean by treating nationalism and globalization as discursive? What I mean is really not defining them, because when you try to define these key terms, it's almost impossible, as I'm sure any of you working on nationalism or globalization already know. I did a quick survey of just three books on recent works on Chinese nationalism, and you can find at least this number of themes that are associated with nationalism. I mean, there's just so many of them, and you could probably add many more, and many of them actually conflict with each other. And it really draws attention to that eternal problem of nationalist studies, that nationalism is a fuzzy concept, as we always say. It changes throughout history, changes with context. And so what I want to do is look at how it is discussed in a certain period in China. Globalization is the same. Of course, our own leading expert on globalization, David Held, and his co-authors give us probably one of the best working definitions of globalization, you know, as a process, set of processes, essentially embodying transformation of social relations and transactions, the sort of shrinkage of transport and communications and so on that we all associate with globalization. One of the problems with this kind of definition, though, and if you read David Held's great work on it, then it's really a way, a perspective of looking at world history, more or less, and you need to cover, you know, where is the historic periodicity of this? Where do we stop? You can look at, you know, it becomes almost unwieldy for academic analysis. Equally, when we look at the relationship between nationalism and globalization, again, there is a huge debate on this in the general academic literature on just how these relate. Of course, there was a period when academics and policymakers tended to assume that nationalism came first and globalization was something eroding the nation state. This was probably a post-Cold War fashion, which with the new wave of wars and sort of consolidation of states that we've seen and securitization of states we've seen more recently, people have had to question that idea of the relationship and come up with more sophisticated ideas that this is a highly complex relationship between the two processes. Now, what I put in here to give you some idea of the problem of periodicity is a quote from a constitutional reformer in China in 1897, Kang Youwei, whose quote could have come really from the current period. You know, he talks about China being in a world of 800,000 li, that's a kind of mile in Chinese measurement, one country among more than 50. The globe has been connected since the end of the Ming Dynasty. Transportation has boomed. The new events of the past 100 years represent change that is unprecedented in the preceding 4,000 years. I put this in because it gives us some idea of the that globalization is not necessarily a new process. In that sense, Held is right, going back right to the beginning of history, that we can see these processes. But certainly in the late Qing dynasty, we see reformers being thinking, and as sociologists would put it, in terms of a globalistic mentality about the impact of communications on China and how its political system will respond to this. Kang Youwei wanted reform, but he wasn't successful. So, But what is interesting about the late Qing Dynasty reformers, and what is still highly relevant today, is that they were facing a problem that reformers in China still face, which essentially is how to import Western functional knowledge, know-how, and investment in order not to destroy Chinese identity and statehood, but to preserve Chinese essence. That paradox, that challenge, has remained central to Chinese politics down to today. It was what Mao Zedong called the Sinification of Marxism. He brought Marxism in and gave it Chinese characteristics so that he could preserve China, not see it disintegrate into some greater Soviet world order. Deng Xiaoping talked about building socialism with Chinese characteristics. So again, it's the Chinese characteristics that are important for Deng, and also he was interested in building what he used to call socialist spiritual civilization and opposing bourgeois liberalization from the West. So again, Deng wanted to bring in Western know-how, technology, investment, but the purpose of it was to strengthen Chinese identity, strengthen the state in a globalizing world. Now, this challenge remains at the core of the tests of legitimacy for today's leadership in China, who have inherited Mao Zedong thought and Deng Xiaoping theory, as it's now called, as the ideological orthodoxy within which all policy making has to be articulated. So that's the sort of orthodox problem within which the discussion of nationalism and globalization is taking place in China. Now, what I mean by discursive is that whether or not we can define these terms isn't that important, because what is important is that they are being discussed in China. Now, this is from a search that we have, this wonderful database that you can all get access to, of nearly all the social science journals in China, published in China going back to 1994. And it does a full text search. And so you can do this yourself. If you just do a search for the key terms, globalization and nationalism, you can see how much these are being discussed, get some idea of the tendency, the trajectory. Going back to 94, you know, globalization was mentioned 34 times in these journals, and going up to 2004, it's gone up to 3,896, an astronomical sort of rise. Nationalism, too, has seen a rise from 35 to 140. You could draw a very crude correlation with some of the key crises that have occurred and events that have occurred both outside China and inside China, which may have given this push along, this increasing discussion. But what we should note here is that both are being discussed more. But what's very interesting, of course, is how much globalization is being discussed more than nationalism. And so we have to bear this in mind when we look at these nationalistic outbreaks, that, you know, the way actually, you know, this is taking in place within a political culture that talks about globalization more than nationalism in many respects, at least amongst academics. But I would argue that this kind of increasing discussion of nationalism and globalization can be seen at all levels of politics, not just the academic journals. If we look at the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, if the orthodoxy now is to describe the world situation as one of economic globalization and political multipolarity. That, of course, is a formula that, going back to what Fred was saying about Confucian IR theory, in a sense, trying to preserve the state-centric international system while benefiting from global markets. If we look at the populist literature that has flourished since the middle 1990s, again, we see a whole wave of popular literature lamenting the spread of Western culture, asking what globalization means for China, and some fairly strong, assertive, nationalistic texts appearing. And of course, we see this above all on the internet, that new forum, not so new these days, but certainly new in the 1990s, that new forum where nationalism has found an outlet that's very hard for the authorities to control and censor. and I'll say more about that later. So there has been a discussion, and I'm not going to try and define the terms, but just look at how they are discussed. I think, though, we can make the research more manageable also by focusing on policy making, as I said at the beginning. This is something that most of the academic work on Chinese nationalism in the English texts hasn't really done. As I said, it tends to give descriptive surveys instead. However, it is fairly easy to trace how the political elite, the leadership, have used nationalism under reform and opening as to develop a new sort of ideological consensus. And this is something I do in the book. We need to go back to Deng Xiaoping when he came back to power after the death of Mao and the short interregnum of the acting chairman Hua Guofeng and the power struggle that took round about that time. And it's really out of that power struggle at the top of the party, factional power struggle, and increasing discontent amongst the general population with the political system and situation, that Deng Xiaoping's reform and opening emerges. Now, for Deng, patriotism became the key element for the new ideological formula. Maoist class struggle was something that, of course, he wanted to put behind him. So he had to replace it with something, and it wasn't going to be democracy. So it was going to be patriotism. Not egalitarianism either. Patriotism, beginning to put socialism behind the Communist Party in the late 70s, and of course what we've seen now in these last few years is socialism has gone completely, but the beginning, it begins with Deng. So Deng began to use patriotism in the late 70s and the early 80s for domestic political purposes, to oppose the remnants of Mao's successors in the leadership, and also to draw the limits of political dissent when he clamped down on the Beijing Spring, and that's not the 1989 one, there was one in 1979, called the Democracy Wall Movement, when people, students largely, did take to the streets, dissidents, to demand the fourth modernization, which was democratization. Sorry, the fifth modernization, because Deng's slogan was four modernizations. They added the fifth, democratization, and this was very quickly clamped down on and suppressed. And it was replaced with a call for patriotism from the young and from the old, a return to the days around the time of liberation, the days of the struggle against Japan and the KMT, the nationalists. Those were the values that Deng wanted to use to underpin reform and opening. But he also needed to link this patriotism with economic reform. And to do that, he proposed three major tasks upon which the leadership of the Communist Party should be judged. And these are the three tasks. And it's very important to remember these, because we tend to think of Chinese economic reform and opening as merely an economic issue, when in fact, from its earliest days in January 1980, Deng made economic construction only one out of three goals that the party was supposed to achieve. And the other two are in foreign policy and unification policy. So the first one is oppose hegemonism and strive to preserve world peace. Well, in 1980, that meant opposing the Soviet Union largely, but now, of course, it means opposing the United States. And the return of Taiwan to the motherland for China's unification. This was made a key issue, that if the communist leadership couldn't achieve this, then the people deserved to kick them out of power, in effect. Economic construction was only the third in the list of these policy goals. So we have foreign policy, unification policy, and economic policy all being linked together, essentially, by patriotism, used for party and domestic political purposes. So that is the essential sort of linkage between policies areas that Deng established and which the current leadership has inherited and has to deal with. So no matter how much it wants to push towards economic reform and opening, it cannot ignore these other two issues. It cannot be seen to be weak in standing up for foreign hegemony, and it cannot be seen to be weak in trying to get Taiwan back to be a part of the motherland. However, this nationalistic formula had to do something else as well. It had to be able to do what those Qing dynasty reformers had been trying to do and has been attempted ever since, which is still have a kind of nationalism that is open enough to accommodate the need to draw in foreign funds and expertise, to balance that importation of functional knowledge from abroad to preserve Chinese essence. So throughout the 1980s, what we see is the reformist leadership, which is far more reformist then than it is now, with Deng Xiaoping's support, building into this nationalistic policy grid themes like the World Technological Revolution. Now, this, of course, in the 80s was the sort of period of Alvin Toffler and the Third Wave, and a lot of those pundits were already talking about the forces of globalization transforming the world. And there were many very receptive ears in the Chinese Communist Party leadership to those sort of arguments. And they realized that you had to build this into your nationalism. The World Technological Revolution became an element of Chinese elite politics. So throughout the 80s, and still going on now, finding the right balance between a backward and inward-looking patriotism and an outward and forward-looking techno-nationalism became central to both the factional and the populist politics of China. Ultimately, though, this new ideological dispensation made the leadership quite vulnerable, because if you're going to make this the sort of ideological discourse, you open yourself up to attack, both from inside the party, from those who are not happy with the way your reforms are going, factional opponents, and also from the broader population, maybe the urban population, the student population, who are not happy with what's happening to their living conditions, either through inflation, through insecurity, through losing jobs and so on. And already in the 80s, there's a lot of insecurity, economic insecurity. So what the people who began to lose out or who were suspicious of the move towards a kind of techno-nationalism began to do was to push back and establish a dynamic which, again, is continuing down to the present. We could see this in the form of things like the anti-spiritual pollution campaign in the early 1980s, which was really launched by factions in the leadership and local party factions who were not happy with the way that the leadership was allowing Western ideas and culture and know-how to come in and to transform what they saw as Chinese purity and essence. Equally, the campaign against bourgeois liberalization, which followed very quickly in the late 1980s, was a sign of this conservative backlash. And a lot of these had quite broad popular support, too. When young women were having their high heels stopped in the streets of Shanghai to have their high heels snapped off their shoes, this wasn't all being done by high-ranking cadres. You know, this was being done by mobs. So there was a certain amount of popular support for this kind of anti-Westernism, if you like, or anti-globalization, early anti-globalization. But on the other side, of course, you got the dynamic of bursts of rapid economic reform, rapid opening up to the outside world, which tried to keep the balance towards reform and opening, keeping the foreign know-how coming in. By 1989, and the Tiananmen massacre, this balance had become unsustainable. At that time, of course, students largely, but not just students, remember, large sections of the urban population took to the streets. And what they did, what's interesting about that period for us, is the way in which they tried to claim the nationalist mantle. They proclaimed that they were the true democrats. They didn't like the inflation, the corruption, what they saw happening around them and to their living standards, and the general way that the reforms were going. They wanted democratization. But the way they spoke about democratization was very much in the same way that their forebears on the 4th of May, 1919, when really spoke about democratization. That, of course, was the symbolic day when the Paris Peace Conference transferred German concessions in China to Japan at the end of World War I, and was the period when we can really say Chinese popular nationalism began, with a demonstration in 1919 of students in Peking against the government for being weak in the face of international pressure. Now, the students in 1989 adopted the symbolism of that 1919 demonstration. They were saying, we are the true patriots. We have this government that's claimed patriotism, but what's it doing? It's destroying our country. So we are the true patriots. And one of the key events that made the demonstrations get much bigger was when the leadership refused to recognize that the students were patriots. So patriotism had become a tool already against the Chinese leadership by 1989. And it had become, at this point, a tool of democratization. The way in which the leadership responded, of course, the leadership was purged in 1989. A new leadership came in under General Secretary Jiang Zemin, who lasted until 2002. But what the new leadership had to do was re-establish their nationalist credentials. And they did this in the context as well of the collapse of the Soviet Union through a patriotic education campaign. And that really gave nationalism a new content, because under Deng Xiaoping, it had been very much looking at the war against Japan in the past and the war of liberation. What Jiang Zemin began to do in the 1990s was to give a new kind of content to nationalism. And that he did that by going back to Chinese tradition. Old practices were revived of leaders going to worship at the tomb of the Yellow Emperor. That discussion about a Confucian IR theory began to appear at this time. The Opium War, in which we played a small part, I guess, was also discussed at great length in patriotic education. And of course, the Nanjing Massacre, the dreadful massacre which took place, massacre of civilians by the Japanese Imperial Army that took place when the Japanese invaded China. All of those were given a new salience, a new visibility in Chinese education, culture, across the board. And this was directly from Jiang Zemin himself. I mean, I've cited several of his speeches in the book, where he says, this is what we need to do. We need to use this opportunity. It was the anniversary of the Opium War, 150th anniversary. We need to use this opportunity to remind the population of why they need the Chinese Communist Party. We need to remind them about the Nanjing Massacre. Why do we want to do it? Not just to tell them about the massacre, but to tell them why they need the Chinese Communist Party to protect them, to save the nation. We are the force of national salvation, and without us, China will be a plate of loose sand, reviving a metaphor first coined by Sun Yat-sen, the father of Chinese nationalism, around about 1924, I believe. So without the Chinese Communist Party, everything will fall apart. So as a response to the nationalist challenge from below, the elite began to remind them why people needed the party. to save them. However, Chang faced that old problem of the technological revolution even more than Deng had done, and even more, of course, far more than the Qing Dynasty reformers had done. This was the time when globalization was really taking off in the 1990s, when the internet was spreading, when trade, the WTO, the GATT was being turned into the WTO, and trade was being liberalized. This was the beginning of a real boost of globalization. So the ideological consensus that emerged had to give a lot of space to that as well. So again, you get this tension between sort of reviving very well-established symbols from the nationalist tradition at the same time as having to develop policies that will somehow allow China to survive in this globalizing world. And the formula that was arrived at was really the formula that Deng Xiaoping presented in his last years. He's on his last legs, and they launched him on this tour of southern China to the booming special economic zones in 1992. And he gave a series of speeches. And that really is the essence of the current ideological formula. And what it does is it departs from socialism once and for all. Revolution is now defined as the liberation of the productive forces. There is no egalitarianism. In fact, inequality is seen as advantageous, with some regions of China having to develop faster than others, with the expectations that the others will catch up later, what Reagan and Thatcher would have called the trickle-down theory of economics. Politically, the model is not, of course, not the Soviet Union. It's become Singapore. Singapore, its authoritarian system, ruling over a market economy, is what Deng sees as the best model for China. There's a slight difference in scale, but he doesn't seem to bother him. But that is the vision in the Southern Tour, which is the last chapter of the third volume of Deng's selected works and is therefore really, you know, what underlines his whole ideological formula. And what this has allowed, this sort of authoritarian developmental state, in effect, is an uneasy balance, the uneasy balance we see today of using Western know-how to preserve Chinese essence across a whole range of policies. Policies that stand right at the interface between China and the world, whether that's education policy or information technology or industrial policy. In all these areas, we can see this ideological formula is used to somehow reach a compromise between bringing in foreign know-how and preserving Chinese identity, and which ultimately means the rule of the Chinese Communist Party. We can see it, perhaps, and I cover a lot of these areas, education policy, looking at textbooks, and the way that school children are taught from a very young age about these heroic history of the Communist Party, the anti-Japanese war, the war against the KMT, and so on and so on. All of those themes can be seen running through education and textbooks, as can the need to import science and technology and so on. The aim is to create, ultimately, what Jiang Zemin calls, in management speak really, a personnel great power. It really is an attempt. Well, if you're going to develop a personnel great power, which means having an education system that develops highly trained people who can deal with foreign investment and technology, it has to address the problem that has dogged Chinese communism since 1949, and which Mao, of course, was never able to resolve, which is the problem of how to reconcile a rising class of experts exposed to globalization with the claim of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, to represent the workers and peasants. Now, Mao, of course, tried to resolve this with the Cultural Revolution by just, you know, persecuting the experts. Deng Xiaoping said if you're an expert, you could be red as well. You could be a communist and be an expert. Well, Jiang Zemin, that was fine in the 80s, perhaps, when there was still a relatively small number of experts. But as these experts, whether they're technocrats or entrepreneurs, have grown in number and their importance has into the economy has grown, this, of course, gives them a new political role. And this has to be accommodated in the emerging ideology. And this is where we stand now with Jiang Zemin's theory of what he called the three represents, where the party's first goal is to represent the advanced forces of production and modernity. And what that did was allow this new class of technocrats and entrepreneurs to become members of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, not all of them joined, of course, but what it did was give them a political status that they had never had before. And putting it in the three represents, alongside Mao Zedong, Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong theory, and Deng Xiaoping theory, means that this is now the official party line, that rising class of experts have a political purpose as part of the Chinese Communist Party's mission of national salvation. Now, for those who have not benefited from reform and opening, that uneasy consensus has left the patriotism of the Communist Party open to challenge. And there are many people, after all, who do feel increasingly insecure. I'm sure that you have all seen the reports from the Chinese countryside of the rising number of disturbances. I think the latest figure is 84,000 last year, disturbances throughout China, group disturbances, many of them taking place in the countryside now, but many, of course, amongst unemployed workers as well, peasants being deprived of their land, demonstrations about corruption, and, of course, the nationalist demonstrations that we've already discussed. But that growing number of discontented people and groups are able to use nationalism just as nationalism was used around the time of 1989 to call to account the leadership. And so what we see really in the 1990s is the beginning of a very interesting, complex attempt by a whole range of groups of intellectuals and popular writers and internet surfers and so on to appropriate the leadership's nationalism and really turn it against the leadership and to say, you know, if you're taking the side of this rising technocratic, elitist, entrepreneurial class, if that's your version of patriotism, what about the rest of us? Why I say this is because it goes back to that issue of why the list of themes that are associated with nationalism is so long. The list I gave at the beginning of this lecture, of all those themes. Now, all of those can be used by people who want to criticize the leadership. You may believe that authoritarianism is the answer in China, in which case you can appeal to nationalism to advocate more authoritarianism. You may believe democratization is the answer, and again, you can appeal to democratization. We need the kind of nationalism that establishes the political foundation of democracy, or we need the kind that establishes the foundation for authoritarianism. There's a whole range of strategies that you can use nationalism for. And those are the themes, after all, that have been legitimated by the party leadership itself, so they can't stop people using them. Amongst academics, there was certainly and continues an intense debate over what kind of nationalism is best for China to survive in a globalizing world. As academics have tried, really what they're trying to do is influence this emerging Communist Party orthodoxy, push it in different directions. But of equal significance is the populist literature, which has again been a product of the reform and opening program, because one of the elements of that has been the development of a commercial publishing industry. And that has allowed more populist literature to appear, and there's a big market for nationalist literature, of course, as goes for the internet too. Now, that growing sort of dissent and dissatisfaction combined with spaces for expressing it, both in cyberspace or on paper or in the academic journals, combined with growing dissatisfaction and the use of nationalist orthodoxy to express this dissatisfaction, can probably be controlled until, that is, issues, crises occur which are beyond the control of the Communist Party, which are outside China, in effect. And that's where those other two areas of policy making that Deng Xiaoping established, foreign policy and unification policy, come back into the picture in a very important way. Because while the party may be able to claim that GDP growth of 8 to 9% a year is what legitimates it, people can say, well, Deng Xiaoping said, it's not just GDP growth that we're after. The whole point of GDP growth is so we can stand up to the US, stand up to Japan, and get Taiwan back. So what are you going to do with all this GDP growth, and how long will it take you? So in effect, what we see in the 1990s is that unification and foreign policy interrupt this development of an ideological consensus in a very big way. The first real test for the leadership was the was the Taiwan Straits crisis of 1995-6. The event was the first election in Taiwan of the president in March 1996, which was something entirely out of the control of the Communist Party, because the democratization in Taiwan was developing and is still developing under its own dynamics. It led, to cut a long story short, to the People's Liberation Army conducting military maneuvers and shooting, firing missile tests near the coast of Taiwan. The US Navy responded with sending in two carrier forces, and there was a very serious military standoff that came to the brink of military conflict. Now, that was all sort of took place under its own momentum, in effect. But within, inside China, this is the time when we see the beginning of this populist nationalism on from the commercial presses. And the first important text is China Can Say No. There are other texts like Behind the Demonization of China, which is about how the US media demonizes China. But China Can Say No is probably the seminal text produced in 1996, shortly after and directly triggered by the Taiwan Strait crisis. What's interesting about this kind of literature is that it's produced by relatively young, unknown authors. Very different, new phenomenon in China, where most of the people who have written before have tended to be people in positions of academic authority. But these are angry young men, I suppose. They want to vent their anger against the US, against Japan, and even against the United Kingdom in some places. They want to express, but also they want to, they're angry with the Chinese themselves, with China's psyche, with what they see as China's unwillingness to stand up for itself in the world, with its weakness, its psychological weakness. So it's a lot of introspection as well. So that already created a serious test for the leadership. It was followed in 1998 by what became really the first real internet-based Chinese nationalist discourse, which was the atrocities that were committed against ethnic Chinese in Indonesia, mainly women who were raped in large numbers during the fall of the Suharto regime. And it was at that time that we began to see the internet playing an important role. It did some key things. It disseminated the information, first of all. This is actually an Indonesian NGO website, but you could access this inside China, even though the Chinese authorities didn't allow the people in China to know about what was going on. They could access these websites on the internet. It also allowed people to voice their dissent on the internet. And it was dissent, first of all, it was anger against Indonesia, of course, but then it became anger against their own government's weak foreign policy. Why isn't our government doing something to protect our brothers and sisters in Indonesia? We always talk about the Chinese being you know, all one flesh and blood and a great nation. And we see this, these atrocities happening. If they were Americans, you know, then the Americans would be in there straight away. Why is it that China cannot take any action? And when the foreign ministry took a relatively weak but probably a reasonable action against Indonesia, this became the focus of increasing dissent, leading to the next function of the internet, which was to organise demonstrations. And illegal demonstrations were held in Beijing at this time. And so we could see again that where the new technologies were opening up spaces to allow this kind of patriotism and nationalism to backfire on the political elite. Just to give you some idea, now this chart's way out. If I updated it, it would go way off, you know, the chart, because I mean, it gives you some idea of the expansion of the internet in China. It's now over 100 million, I think. Just last year, it went through the 100 million mark. But you could see that already in 1998, what we're talking about now, this was a fairly small number of users who are already using it in this way. And now, you know, it's gone way up to 100 million. So that gives you some idea of the impact that this can have. And it certainly played a role in the next foreign policy crisis, which was the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999 during the NATO campaign against Serbia. And this, of course, brought crowds onto the streets of Chinese cities who were throwing bricks at embassies, the US embassy, of course, in particular. Again, the internet played a large role in this. But what's interesting at this point is how the state tries to use the internet to come back, to recapture nationalism and reappropriate it. And you can't really see it, but this is from the Beijing Youth Daily, and it's all about the internet war between China and the US, and hacking, which began in a large scale at this time. What's interesting about it, of course, is that it's actually got some internet addresses here. You know, the DOI, Department of the Interior, Department of the Environment in the US. So this, you know, is a good way of putting this on the front page of a Chinese newspaper. And anyone can then go ahead and join in this hacking war, you know. Equally, you could go onto Chinese websites and you would see, you know, whole lists of, you know, here's the White House, Law Department, NATO, you know. I mean, and it gives you instructions on how to actually ping these websites. If everyone, you know, it's just where you test out if the website's responding. If you all do it at the same time, of course, the websites collapse. This was all, you know, if there's an argument about how much the state encourages this kind of thing, but certainly there is plenty of evidence to show that that it doesn't actually try to control it that much when it's directed against the US or NATO. Well, equally, we can see around about this time the state beginning to develop its own websites and its own chat forums, like the People's Daily Online Strong State Forum, which is actually a very interesting forum, but which, you know, is really, the title, Strong State Forum, says very much about the kind of content where you'll find people really letting off steam against Japan, against the US, and so on. There's a lot of discussion on why the state does this, because a lot of this actually is quite, what appears on the Strong State Forum is quite critical of the Chinese government. And one of the theories is it's a way of letting off steam, you know, that we don't know. but it's certainly most of the, you know, we get a very large amount of very strongly nationalistic content in Chinese cyberspace, which disappointed perhaps many of those people who maybe rather naively believed in the early 90s that the spread of the internet to China would bring about sort of liberal democracy or the American way of life. In fact, what we see is that it reflects very much the underlying existing values and political orthodoxy of nationalism. Anyway, and so we've seen this really, as we've seen the crises multiply, really, you know, in the last few years over both Taiwan and Japan, we've seen this kind of heightening of nationalistic activity. Just to give you a few figures here, you know, this was when the president of Taiwan, Li Donghui, broke a political taboo by saying that the Taiwan and mainland China were two states, and this immediately there was this cyber warfare began from both sides. And some of this this way of conducting warfare was systematized by people in the Chinese military, and again appeared as best-selling books under titles like Unlimited War, yeah, which is a sort of manual produced by middle-ranking PLA officers on telling you how to engage in internet war, smuggling, germ warfare, based largely on foreign experience. The financial warfare in there, I think, is based on George Soros, one of our distinguished alumni. And, you know, that's essentially how to use China's financial resources to destabilize the financial markets, given the way in which the Chinese are at present subsidizing the U.S. deficit. This has, maybe American policymakers should take some note of this. And of course, let's get back to where we began, really, which is Japan, and which is really the biggest issue that China faces, far more serious in many ways than the United States relationship. And here again, we've seen since certainly the early, since 2000, a whole lot of issues, events occurring inside Japan, which have got nothing to do with the Chinese state or the Communist Party, but which are purely driven by Japan's domestic politics, such as the revisionist attempts to revise history of the Nanjing Massacre, and which more recently we've seen in the attempts to the actual approval of new textbooks in Japan, which sort of whitewash the Japanese invasion of China. And this, again, of course, had the predictable reaction of creating this same kind of nationalistic fervor and activity. Which brings me back, really, to where I began, which is brings us up to date, to those demonstrations that we saw last year. This is really where they have come from, this combination of these interrelationship between domestic reform, foreign policy, and unification policy. Now, for the present leadership in China, this is increasingly difficult to deal with. The demonstrations in Japan last year weren't just organized by internet, they were organized by cell phone. There was a massive petition organized. Demonstrators were told where to go. There was a decentralized organization. No one knew who organized it, but this message just spread on people's cell phones. There's a cat and mouse game of technology going on. And the state has to rely on that class of technocratic entrepreneurs to consolidate its control over this activity. That's why we've seen these issues of Google and Microsoft in the news recently, because, of course, the game becomes increasingly difficult, increasingly sophisticated, and means drawing in foreign experts. And it was obvious that there would have to be a coalition between this technocratic class in China and global industries, which we've now seen, which are sort of more or less working together on trying to keep control of these new technologies and their content and the activities that they can spur. So, for the present leadership, these kind of events highlight the difficult relationship between economic policy, foreign policy, and unification policy that they have inherited from their predecessors. In foreign policy, the official line is that China needs 70 years of peace to complete its economic development. And that gives rise to the discourse on the peaceful rise of China, which is the message that the Chinese government and academics are trying to put across to us. China is a peacefully rising power. It is not like Wilhelmine Germany. It is not like Imperial Japan, previously rising powers, which eventually clashed with the world system and resorted to warfare. China is a peacefully rising power. That's the message. The Chinese government draws attention to its recent record in promoting regional multilateral trade agreements and taking part in multilateral security organizations, such as the ASEAN Regional Forum for Southeast Asia and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization for Central Asia, where it has done some remarkably new things in terms of its multilateralism. However, this view of China does have to be balanced with those other aims of Chinese communist policy upon which the legitimacy of the leadership depends, which is achieving unification with Taiwan and opposing hegemony, now phrased more as promoting multipolarity. Well, the dominant theory in our discipline, international relations, since the end of the Cold War, has been constructivism, which proposes that the way that states behave in the world depends on the values that they harbour and that they promote. That's what shapes foreign policy behaviour. A lot of commentators on China's international relations and foreign policy say that issues like Taiwan are exceptions to the rule, that what we should look at is the multilateralism and not those issues of Taiwan or Japan. Those are exceptions. But if my argument is right, then the core values of achieving unification and standing up to what is seen as US and increasingly Japanese hegemony, those are the rules, not the exceptions. Because it's those goals that are the standards that have been set under reform and opening, and against which the demonstrators in Shanghai last year wanted to hold their leaders to account. So I'll finish on that.
This is open for questions.
Just say thank you for your speech tonight. And my question is, there is any difference between the perspective of Chinese authority on nationalism and the perspective from younger Chinese? Whenever, maybe in May 4th in 1919 or June 4th in 1989 or after Tiananmen Massacre, there is any difference of the two perspectives?
Well, I mean, the context is completely different. Of course, the historical context is wildly different. But the strategy is the same. And the strategy is to use these, what is seen as weakness in standing up to foreign aggression, to attack and criticize the government. And not just to attack it for its weakness, but to take that a step further and say, this shows that we need also political reform. So I think, you know, this is why I want to be quite careful when people tend to take a completely negative view of Chinese nationalism. One of the things I've been careful to do is draw attention to the way that it can be used to actually promote democratization, to promote liberalization of the political system. And I think you can see that in 1919 and 1989. I'm not so sure about the recent demonstrations. I think, you know, last year in Shanghai, I think it is the same kind of strategy again. I mean, many of these people were apparently white-collar workers, which was interesting. They weren't just students. And, you know, one of the theories is that they are feeling insecure about the way that the reforms are going. So I think obviously the context is different, but the strategy underneath is very similar, and the symbolism, of course, and it's a deliberate use of one after another to copy what went before and identify themselves consciously with their predecessors to make a kind of tradition, a pro-liberal, liberalizing, democratic form of nationalist tradition, really.
Dr. Hughes, it's a very interesting lecture. I have a question. Many scholars stress on the nationalism in China. They give me an impression is that there is only nationalism nowadays spread out in China. But the thing is, either in the mainstream media or in the internet, there's a very strong power of anti so-called extreme narrow nationalism movement. There's lots of debate in the internet, and you can see that the opening of so-called Qianggulentan, the strong state forum, is not only spreading the nationalism mood, but also spreading all kinds of so-called liberalism mood, such as anti-corruption and the discussion about political reform, and the significance of the Qianggulentan is not only spreading nationalism, and the other thing I think you can see that neither Wang Xiaodong or Qiao Bian or Qiao Liang are not so-called mainstream scholar or mainstream authors in China nowadays. I guess you have lots of contact with Mr. Wang Xiaodong, and he keeps denying that he can publish his article, his idea freely on Chinese media or even internet. So can you stress more about the other way of the political concerns or the idea, that, which I mean, I don't want to use the term anti-nationalism, but there's the other way. There's a debate in China. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree, and I thank you really for emphasizing that, because it's always a danger when you talk about Chinese nationalism. Yeah, we do pay attention to the more extreme outbreaks and symbols and so on. And one of the things I have gone to some lengths to do is to show exactly what you've said, how, especially in the mid-1990s, you mentioned Wang Xiaodong, who of course came and gave a lecture here last year. Doesn't mean I approve of his ideas or anything, but he's someone who's sort of had influence through the commercial press and on the internet. But one of the things he was arguing against was, his main opponent was Li Shengzhi, the much older, veteran kind of diplomat, who engaged in a long debate over many years in the 90s over the nature of what kind of nationalism is right for China. And many other scholars took part in this too, and you've got spinning off from this ideas about a sort of neo-Confucian type of nationalism, a soft kind of nationalism, a liberal nationalism, and so on. And that's exactly right, yeah. So it opens up a kind of space, nationalism, for discussing, what is very difficult to discuss in other ways, because it's quite difficult to advocate democracy in China. But it's much easier to say we need a kind of nationalism that will establish the foundations for a more liberal society. So it opens up a strategy, I think, for academics in particular to promote democratization and to promote liberalization. And that's very important. But that, of course, then raises a challenge for the leadership, because we are talking about, and this goes back a bit to Fred's original question, what's special about China? What's special about it is it's a one-party state. And the party has to have an ideology that says why it's there, that legitimates its rule. Now, there are many divisions in the party leadership, but what holds them together, I think, is this view of themselves as saving the Chinese nation, that they are the things, that they are the organization that holds it together. Now, if you want to change that, you could argue we should have multi-party electoral liberal democratic system, and it's not going to get you very far. But instead, better strategy is to say, look, you have justified yourselves by saying you are there in position to stand up to China, to hold us together, to stand up for China, to oppose Japan and stand up against the US, but you can't do it. And if you can't do it, then maybe what we need is a change of the political system. You know, in fact, even Wang Xiaodong argues this. He says he's a Democrat these days, and says what we need is a more democratic political system, which would increase the power of the nation, because you know it would hold us together better. There's something wrong with the current system if it's not able to meet those goals that were established by Deng Xiaoping. And you could apply that to Taiwan, of course, as well, and we had the visit from Ma Ying-jeou, the mayor of Taipei, a few weeks ago that some of you may have come to. And his argument now is that, you know, unification with China can only come when China democratizes. So again, what you get is a linkage between unification and democratization. And the ball is then in the court of the Chinese Communist Party. If you really want unification, don't do it by maintaining the one-party system, do it by democratizing, and then you'll create the conditions for unification with China. Well, whether you really believe that that's possible or not is a bit beside the point. It's certainly a way to criticize the existing one-party state that you have in China. So it's very complex, many strategies involved. Yeah.
Yes, I'd like to. I can see your argument is that China is sort of edging towards democracy or a liberal kind of state. I have quite a different view of it for three reasons. One is China has no culture of democracy, either in the imperial past or in the present. Two, the nations in the world to try and compete economically with China, and Britain is very much in the forefront, are in a way getting less democratic in a way to compete with China. So China will not have the obstacles. Now people don't go to China to talk about Tiananmen Square or abuses of human rights so much, because China just pulls too much weight. So I think the other nations are becoming Sinified in their approach to China, and China is under less pressure. The third reason, I think so, is very recent, and that is China has suddenly realised the bandwagon that the global warming and the loss of raw resources is an open go for them, because only by having an authoritarian government that's game to clamp down on usage of raw resources are you going to be able to keep the world going. And I saw even yesterday the Chinese government pledged that by 2015, 15% of the power in China will be used by renewables. Now, this is a very recent development, I think the Communist Party will actually strengthen its power once the resource business gets really strong and prices really go through the roof. The Chinese government, in fact, they'd have a big chance to actually cement power rather than lose power. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I don't think I said that China's becoming more democratic. I think if we look at China at any period, there are always very rich discussions and debates going on about the nature of the political system, even during the Mao period. And of course, there are more spaces now for those debates to go on. I don't see it becoming, I don't see any institutional change on the cards. And really, that's not part of my argument. You know, my argument is that there is certainly plenty of evidence to show that people use nationalism to criticize the one-party state. I don't see they've been successful in actually changing it yet. But what it has done is make the state itself become more nationalistic. So in effect, you know, it's not becoming more democratic, it's using nationalism more. Certainly under Jiang Zemin we saw that. Maybe under Hu Jintao it's been different, because he's relied more on economic policies to try and legitimate himself and his leadership. But those economic policies are now running into big problems, of course, as we see with the current new five-year plan and its emphasis on the countryside and the outbreak of disturbances all over China that we read about every day. So The issue then is whether that will encourage Hu Jintao to try to strengthen his leadership by resorting more to nationalism. I don't see any evidence for that at the moment, but what we can say is he's certainly constrained against addressing the fundamental challenges in foreign policy that he faces. To give you an example, in the relationship with Japan, now, what many Chinese often point out to me is the Japanese anti-Japanese demonstrations didn't only take place in China, they took place in South Korea as well. South Korea is a democracy. Now, that's true, but the difference is the way that the South Korean leadership could handle this. The South Korean president has regular meetings with the Japanese prime minister, summit meetings, bilateral. The Chinese leadership have not met the Japanese prime minister for, I think, nearly 3 years now. They've had no bilateral meetings because of the domestic constraints. You know, they would not dare to be seen talking to Koizumi. It would undermine their legitimacy, which is already weak due to all these economic problems. So those are the issues I'm getting at more than, you know, I see the question over whether it's going to be democratic or not is a bit beyond my remit. You know, I'm not suggesting it's becoming more democratic. There's just a very rich discussion going on. As for, I am concerned, like you are, about the way that other states in the world are sort of becoming, are using China as the sort of icon of globalization and almost a new economic model that we should be following, you know, which Blair and Brown in particular are fascinated with China and keep visiting. Brown in particular, John Prescott was there a couple of weeks ago, I think. So was Boris Johnson, I believe.
Some of our colleagues at LSE are fascinated.
Well, some of our colleagues are quite interested in Chinese banks and so on. Yeah. Anyway, but that concerns me too. But on the other hand, I tend to look at this as one wave in what we've seen of many waves of the political classes in this country looking abroad to create a sort of model, you know, whether it was Japan in the sort of 1980s, then Southeast Asia in the early 1990s till the financial crash in 97. Now it's China. We don't know how long that will last before they move on to Russia or India, you know, but there are other candidates who are up and coming. And I get the feeling that the shine may be wearing off China a bit because of the nature of the political and environmental problems that are becoming more and more visible all the time. And the irony is that the more people become interested in a place like China, the closer they look at it, and the more they become aware of the problems. And you know, so maybe it's a phase we're going through. And the global warming, though, there I would disagree with you, because many of the policies that people are talking about now, such as the new green environmental, you know, GDP policy and so on, and also, you know, paying more attention to the farmers and also, you know, putting more money into education. Well, these policies have come back again and again since 1980. You know, you can see more or less the same policy. The problem for China is implementation. Now, you know, with this system, it's not efficient. That's its problem when you talk about sustainability. And I think inside China there are many people who are arguing that what is needed is the rule of law. That without the rule of law, no matter what the government says, how much money it puts into the countryside, what it says about the environment, that people at the local level will just ignore it. You know, and that's the weakness of the one-party state on this scale. So there's been a strong movement in China, at all levels, from the grassroots up to the elements quite high up in the party, in the environmental ministry and so on, who have been arguing we need the rule of law, and that these peasant uprisings have been are democratic, and we should respect what they're saying, you know, and we should do something about it. Well, the current leadership is trying to do something in the five-year plan, but it won't work, as many people in China are saying, without the rule of law. So that may be different from democracy. I'm not sure if you can have the rule of law without democracy. But, you know, I think it's an argument against the authoritarian state as the only organization that can stop global warming. It can't. It hasn't stopped it in China. It doesn't have the ability because it's not efficient. You need to have accountability in the rule of law, functioning courts who can enforce regulations and so on. That's what China's problem is. And so if we want sustainability, that's where it should be addressed.
We need to have two more questions.
Yeah.
Thank you, Professor. Professor, thank you for your very good informative analysis. I have two questions. The first question is, China, since 1978, economic reform is very good, but how about political reform? My question is, economic reform since 1978 is very good, but how about the political reform? Is still very slow or impossible any democracy in the future? Can you have any idea? The second point is, will China take a more active role in international global order to promote peace and security, global security in the future? Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the first, the economic reform has not been accompanied by political reform. That's obvious. Where there has been some at the village level elections and so on, and I think county level elections, but the big expectation was that this would move up to the provincial level and then hopefully up further, that there'd be elections from below would sort of expand until you have elections throughout the system. But it stopped, it stalled around about 2000, I think, where, there was a round of local elections, and then it hasn't gone any further. This was one of the issues that Tony Blair raised, I think, when he visited Beijing for his summit meeting, was that we hope for the elections to move up to the provincial level. The way that the party is run, the way that the leaders are appointed, the role of factions, the strong role of local governments, and the tensions between local government and the central government and party organizations, they're all still there, and it's hard to see any progress on those issues. As for the international global order, that was the point I really finished my talk on, where, yes, we have to give China credit for its move towards multilateralism. In the Cold War, China did not trust multilateral organizations. China saw them as a front for the United States, and they were probably right. But since the early 1990s, China has engaged in regional multilateralism. And that's a conscious decision. And again, there are many discussions inside China about why this is good for China to engage in the WTO as well, in order to shape the emerging rules of the emerging international system. However, that tends to get a lot of attention from academics and in the media. But my argument is that that's one side of the story, and that what is more important ultimately are those other issues of unification with Taiwan and standing up against, at the moment, Japanese, what's seen as Japanese aggression almost, and the threat. And how are these things going to be reconciled by the Chinese leadership? This is the challenge they're going to face over the next 2 years on the international scene. We can expect there to be a referendum in Taiwan probably next year. We don't know what on yet, but it's not going to be go down well in China, in Beijing. There will be a parliamentary election in Taiwan next year. There'll be a presidential election in March 2008. That's just before the Olympic Games, of course, in Beijing in the summer of 2008. Hong Kong, we could bring that into. They have to appoint a new chief executive in Hong Kong next year, and no one knows how that's going to be done. And in Japan, we see this move towards a stronger alliance with the US, development of theater missile defense systems, an increasingly sort of anti-Chinese sentiment in Japan driving elections. We see Koizumi stepping down, but his successor probably being more anti-China than even Koizumi. So those are the problems that China will have to deal with. So talking about Southeast Asia, where China faces no threats, or Central Asia, where there's no real threat now, is easy. But what do you do when you face Japan and Taiwan, which directly impact on those challenges that Deng Xiaoping established as the criteria for your legitimacy as leaders? That's the challenge for China. And so far, we've seen them unable to be flexible on either Taiwan or Japan. My argument is that's because of this domestic nationalism.
Is that one last question?
Yeah, sure.
Thanks. Just quickly, and just to follow up on what you said about Tibet, do you have some kind of feeling from this kind of grassroots nationalism about what they think about Tibet? And it seems kind of implicit that actually Beijing would have no incentive to reach an agreement because it would seem like it would be kind of caving into the West in a way. So, thanks.
Yeah. Tibet, we don't, obviously China's not going to change its position on Tibet, its policy that Tibet is a part of China, and that's not in the foreseeable future, if ever. However, what's interesting really is how India has sort of more or less accepted China's position on this. How will that last? We don't know, but that's interesting. But for the politics of Chinese nationalism, Tibet really is, and I discuss this in the book, it's one of those issues that links domestic unity with the unity with Taiwan and Hong Kong, that there's a kind of very messy linkage, a very important linkage. I mean, in China's mind, if Taiwan becomes de jure independent, then this will sort of show weakness that will then spill over into Tibet and Xinjiang and all those other places, and then they will break away. So there's a kind of important linkage there. The policies towards Tibet are not encouraging, I think, if you're Tibetan. The belief that you can resolve these issues with Tibet and Xinjiang essentially through economic development is something that's been tried now for 20 years, and the result has been a lot of suffering. A lot of people killed, frequent uprisings, not so recently in Tibet, but it was crushed really in 1989 by Hu Jintao, when he was the governor of Tibet, or party secretary there. In Xinjiang, there's been frequent uprisings right up to the 1990s, and now, of course, that's been incorporated in the War on Terror, which goes back to your issue on the international sort of linkage of this, because in that respect, in Xinjiang, the U.S., China, one of the big gains China has got from the globalization of the War on Terror is that the U.S. has recognized the East Turkestan Independence Movement as a terrorist organization, whereas before 9/11, of course, it saw them as sort of freedom fighters of some sort, or on all those issues, the global sort of movement towards securing states and securitizing states doesn't all go well for those secessionist movements, who is going to support them externally? No one really will support Tibet now. Okay.
I think we have to bring this to a close. I'm sure many more questions, and these issues will be with us for a long time. I'd like to thank Chris very much for a very fascinating talk, thinking with the Middle Eastern ear of the role of domestic opinion in authoritarian Middle Eastern states like Egypt, Syria, Iraq, where, again, it sets limits on what the rulers can do. I'd urge you all to buy his book, Chinese Nationalism in the Global Era. It looks excellent. I hope that nothing, the Chinese press are here this evening, I hope that nothing controversial is reported, or that the LSE website is not bombarded by 100 million Chinese by tomorrow morning. So, Chris, thank you very much indeed, and all the best. Cheers.